Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of November 4th, 2016. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Very well, D.R. So, D.R., a couple of big events this week, and perhaps the biggest of the big, has taken place in... I don't know. It's probably globally, right? It's not. There's no specific place it's taking place. But this today, November 4th, 2016, the so-called Paris Agreement comes into official force, right, DR?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's tell me, what is changing today that is different from all other days, to coin a phrase?
Well, it's sort of the first day of the rest of our lives, so to speak, that this is going to be the official implementation of the policy that, if fully implemented, if all countries that agree to the agreement
go all along the parties to the agreement, yeah.
If all the parties basically, you know, live up to their goals, that we are going to be able to limit the increase of warming to at least 1.5 degrees Celsius. Obviously, the goal is to stay under 2 degrees, but the focus is on staying under 1.5 degrees Celsius. The New York Times notes that that may prove problematic because even if every country fully accomplishes its initial pledges, according to the International Energy Agency, the increase will be closer to 2.7 degrees. So we're going to have to sort of move even more aggressively than what is in the stated text of the agreement.
Right. So I think that on November 4th, what is happening is that the agreement takes the force of law in the countries who have signed on to it. And all of a sudden that makes things much more different. You can't, it's not so easy to back out. Everyone remembers, or if you don't remember, I'll tell you that in the Paris Agreement, basically each individual country promised an individually determined amount of carbon dioxide that they would promise and commit to reducing over the next, 5 years, I think is the number, right? Mm-hmm. So each country said, we're going to take X amount of carbon dioxide out of our emissions, reduce it by X amount. And that was a promise as part of the negotiation, but as of November 4th, that takes the force of law, right? So that in these countries, in particular, say, for example, the United States, this is now an agreement that has been fully realized. The United States is a member of it, and we have promised to reduce our carbon emissions by 30% by, I guess it is 2030, right? We've made this promise, and now we have to live up to it. It's a different ball of wax, right? There are sort of legal consequences to the agreement.
Yes, yes, and it will be interesting to see just which countries prove to be the most aggressive in terms of meeting their agreements and which countries turn out to be the least aggressive, and whether or not citizens will try to make those countries which would otherwise turn out to be laggards in terms of meeting up to their commitments, whether or not citizens can make sure those governments live up to what they said they're going to do.
Right. I mean, this is all promises, right? There's very little enforcement. And I think one of the reasons the Paris Agreement was able to be struck is because there's no enforcement within the treaty to make a country meet its goals, right? It's all sort of a public shaming if you don't meet your goals.
Yes.
And that is that we hope is a powerful thing. And as you said, the sum total of all of the commitments to reduce carbon dioxide from all the different countries, which is now part of law, is not sufficient to really meet the target. Right? Mm-hmm. So, in other words, as you just said, I mean, if we did everything that's been promised, we still overshoot the 2 degree mark. We get hotter than the 2 degree rise over the. And so, part built into the Paris Agreement is the phrase you'll hear is increasing ambition. that in 5 years, these countries are all going to come back and say, oh, yeah, yeah, we promised X amount in 2015, but now we're going to promise X plus Y, because we're more ambitious now about reducing our carbon, right?
Exactly. And there is something to be said about various governments wanting to sort of corner the market on clean energy and using this agreement as a catalyst for doing as much as possible to spur investment in clean energy technology. You know, this phrase you often hear, I think Senator Ed Markey often uses, about being the Saudi Arabia of clean energy, the Saudi Arabia of solar, the Saudi Arabia of wind. Which country will accomplish that goal? And in so doing, which other countries will be essentially envious of country X or Y becoming the clean energy champion and then strive to sort of meet that goal as well? That is what is going to be, you know, a sort of, I don't want to use the term nationalism, but a sort of international competition of sorts, you know, an Olympics of clean energy, if you will, which country or countries will get the gold medal.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, it is a, we hope to talk at some point in the not too distant future about an article that discusses whether or not that sort of national competitive model is a good one, right, for attacking climate change, because we're all still on the same planet. But the concept of a friendly competition to see who can make the cleanest energy, that's a good thing. I mean, I think the other thing to note about this event today on the 4th of November is that it is part of the Obama legacy. As you well know, this treaty in Paris, the agreement in Paris, was basically facilitated by Obama meeting the Chinese president, right? The two biggest economies, this is now 18 months ago, more than that, 2 years ago, they got together, and that was sort of the precursor for the Paris Agreement. I mean, that was the bedrock on which, once those two big economies were in, then all the other countries decided to sign up. And so it's a tribute to Obama, but it's even a further tribute is that once that agreement was made last December, almost a year ago now, the approval process went much faster than anyone expected. And in fact, now on the 4th of November, anyone who's got a pulse in the United States knows that that is 4 days before our presidential election. And that the fact that we're in this Paris Accord agreement now legally binding means that the next president cannot, no matter who he or she is, can't wiggle out of this. I mean, we're in it, right? That's a good thing.
Exactly. And if whoever is, becomes the next president does try to wiggle out of it, there will be plenty of concerned citizens making their voices heard to make damn sure they don't.
Well, in fact, and I think we've said this before, but the agreement is cleverly written that you cannot pull out for 4 years. And then you still need a cooling off period of a year. So it's almost impossible for the next president to back out of the Paris Accord. Now, that person may not want to work hard on reaching the American goals, which have been a promise, right? Because there's no enforcement. But still in all, we're in the agreement. We can't be taken out of it. So that's
And you do have to. And you do have to think about the sort of international humiliation that would occur if a president tried to sort of wiggle their way out of it. Think back to when President George W. Bush abandoned the Kyoto Protocol and the international condemnation that occurred, including a lot of condemnation in his own country. And in fact, it significantly hurt his approval ratings for that in the spring of 2001. So if another president decides to do something similar in terms of thumbing their nose at international attitudes and international agreements to try to engage in an international breach of contract, it might not go over well politically.
Well, let's hope we don't have to find out about, you know, that the whoever the next president is, that they, that he or she supports the Paris Accord, and it is a mechanism, a groundwork, a technology, so to speak, for addressing climate change, and we are very happy that the Paris Accord is in place. So there's that. Put that on the wall. That's a good thing. The other interesting sort of social phenomena that has bubbled up this over this past week has been the release of a movie by someone that almost everyone knows, who I keep forgetting his name, but Leonardo DiCaprio, right, is an actor. He's now in his mid-30s, I guess, but for the last 15 years or so, he has been an aggressive climate hawk. And mm-hmm. he put together a movie to talk about climate change. And so, DR, let me ask you, what's the deal? What should people know about this movie and what's in it and what the reaction to it is?
Yes, the movie is Before the Flood. It premiered on National Geographic Channel on October the 30th, and also National Geographic allowed the movie to be distributed for free online, and it should be still available for free right through this weekend. It is what I thought was the greatest climate documentary of all time, far superior even to An Inconvenient Truth. DiCaprio literally travels the world depicting the impact of human-caused climate change. He speaks to climate scientists such as Jason Box and Dr. Michael Mann. He speaks to President Obama, to Pope Francis, to Secretary of State John Kerry, and just does an extraordinary job of explaining, number one, how long the world has known about this problem, number two, the litany of forces arrayed against doing anything about this problem, and number three, the actions that individuals and governments can take to solve this problem. It is just just an amazing, amazing job, and hats off to Leonardo DiCaprio and the producer and the director, Fisher Stevens, for just putting together what is a titanic, if you will, documentary on this issue.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it. I liked it in the sense that DiCaprio was able to give sort of first a context, but then he goes into what amounts to current events. So he takes mm-hmm. you to the Paris Accords, the whole meeting in Paris, and mm-hmm. this is after having traveled to various troubling spots around the world. Go to Paris, understand what that means. Has a audience with a Pope and blah blah blah. But what it did is it put it all in a context, and he talked to people in a way that made it sound. It gave it a good context for people to understand sort of the scope of what is happening, right?
Mm-hmm. And there are two critical segments in the film. One in which he discusses India's carbon footprint with an Indian environmental activist named Dr. Sunita Narain. Uh-huh. And in a memorable segment of the film, Dr. Narain asks DiCaprio how the United States can lecture India about India's need to curb its own carbon appetite when the United States will not curb its own carbon appetite. And Leonardo DiCaprio has this sort of visible wince on screen as if he does realize that Dr. Narain is telling the truth, that the United States won't stem its own, lust for more carbon. And there's also a great segment building off the 2014 segment in the Harrison Ford segment of the 2014 documentary Years of Living Dangerously, discussing deforestation in Indonesia and the sort of lust for palm oil from Indonesia and how it sort of ends up in all of our sort of junk food and all of our sort of household products, and how so many of us don't realize just how much suffering and how much how much suffering across the planet is being done in the name of cheap stuff that we really don't need.
That's one of the things that did surprise me. I mean, he goes to Sumatra, I think it was, and mm-hmm. Huge swaths of rainforest that have been sort of trapping carbon for a long time are all plowed down, and they've got these, I guess they're palm trees, right? Palm oil mm-hmm. trees, and all that goes into your Cheetos and your Fritos and. Mm-hmm. I guess I didn't realize that. It's a cheap edible vegetable oil, and that's what they use. So, it's funny, you could be a climate activist by trying to curb your Cheetos habit. Right? Mm-hmm. And now I'm looking at the various things that I eat and say, how much palm oil is in it? And, mm-hmm. and it sort of comes back to the whole question of sort of the local vore, eating locally, eating an apple. Right, and not going after this processed food, because that's where all the badness is.
And speaking of food, there's also the great discussion about our diets and sort of the carbon footprint of agriculture. And DiCaprio basically suggests that just switching from beef to chicken would do so much to sort of reduce emissions. And you know, we discuss all the time about just the gigantic footprint, carbon footprint of big ag, and how that could be reduced if people simply reconsidered what they eat.
Yeah, I mean that's a message that's been put out before, right? That the meat guzzler, but he makes a nice case for it. And it does make it seem simple. A couple of things. One is that the scene with the Indian minister, Dr., what was her name?
Narain.
You're right that Andrew DiCaprio was looking for a hole to crawl in because she was just so accurate, and she wasn't taking any happy talk from DiCaprio. And she was basically calling out the hypocrisy of the system, right? In a place like India that needs energy for development. I mean, just it's a basic human fairness. It's not clear to me that he provided a great answer. Although I think, if I remember correctly, in the next scene, he's either flying or driving down a freeway in Los Angeles, basically admitting what an enormous carbon footprint he, and by implication, all Westerners, right? And I think that you know, you and I. And everybody listening to this podcast, if you have electricity, you probably have a much larger carbon footprint than some poor person in India, right?
Yes.
And so it really does bring home sort of the inequality and the need for what can only be, environmental justice, right? You don't want to overuse that phrase, but boy, it's really true that they are getting the short end of the stick.
Yes. Now, we do have to acknowledge three interesting aspects of the film. Number one, the fact that the film so extensively criticizes the Fox News Channel's role in climate change denial, which is interesting because it was broadcast on National Geographic, which is overseen by James Murdoch, the son of Rupert Murdoch, who runs 21st Century Fox, which is obviously, you know, known for giving us the Fox News Channel. The rumors about James Murdoch not liking Fox News tend to be true. Number two, another interesting controversy, which was brought up by a film reviewer named Keith Watson of Slant Magazine, is that there is no acknowledgement in the movie or even in the credits, which surprised me, of Bill McKibben and 350.org. Now, some of Bill McKibben's allies, Naomi Klein and Reverend Lex Yearwood, are acknowledged in the credits, but Bill McKibben is not. Climate activism and civil disobedience and what have you is represented early on by a shot of the People's Climate March, but you don't see McKibben in any capacity. I do wonder if there's a director's cut of this documentary in which there was an interview with McKibben. And another interesting thing is that other than an audio clip at the beginning, you see nothing of James Hansen. Curiously and interestingly enough, Harvard economist Gregory Mankiw is brought out to discuss the merits of federal carbon pricing. And it's interesting that they had Mankiw make this point when Jim Hansen is most commonly associated with the need for a federal carbon price. So it's very, very interesting. And it is a fair criticism that a movie dealing with this issue should have had McKibben and Hansen more prominently involved. I think even without McKibben and Hansen, I would still call it the greatest climate documentary of all time. But I cannot gainsay the argument that McKibben's perspective and Hansen's perspective should have been included.
Well, I guess it's interesting. If you're making a movie and you want to appeal to everyone, right? Mm-hmm. Not people that are already committed, right? You want to get to people who are new to the topic. It seems like a good thing to recruit someone like Mankiw. So Mankiw is funny name. It's Mankiw, right?
Is
the way he spells the name. He was the economist for George W. Bush.
And also for Mitt Romney as well.
So he has conservative bona fides. Right, he's in a sense is not the crazy lefty liberal kind of climate hawk, and so I think at that level, for him to call for carbon tax, which I hate it when they say carbon tax because that's like a non-starter, right? Mm-hmm. Carbon fee and dividend or something. But I mean, to have someone who comes from, shall we say, the quote unquote other side of the aisle, can only lend credibility to the need. So I would say the fact that they didn't use Hansen maybe was a good thing. Because you get some varying perspectives in the movie.
It is an interesting point. It just seemed that considering we all know some of the controversies over Hansen's criticisms of what he calls Big Green and Hansen's own efforts to try to reach out to conservatives to try to get them on board. So that's from that perspective, one can argue that it would not have been problematic to include Hansen. Never, I mean, there's nothing that Mankiw says that's necessarily wrong or necessarily factually in error. It was just striking that Mankiw was the person making the case for carbon pricing as opposed to the sort of the number one advocate, I would say, for doing so, and number two, a man who was so prominent in raising awareness about the problem of carbon pollution.
So we'll be the movie reviewers on TV. Is it a thumbs up or a thumbs down, DR?
Two thumbs way up.
Okay, I got both my thumbs up. If you get a chance, yeah, we'll try and put a link to the movie, which I still you can still get for a few more days at least for free online. Yes. And DR. So this has been a good week. We have the Paris Agreement takes effect, and we have a good movie. We agree on a movie. So I will have to leave it there. We'll tell everybody there's links to what we discussed at the blog. It's massclimateaction.org/blog. Please leave a comment. You can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. You can find us on your smartphone at Stitcher and TuneIn Radio and SoundCloud and all those kind of places. You can find us on iTunes, even old-fashioned iTunes. Huh? So, DR, we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty to speak out, we must insist in... right there in company with Mr. Mankiw and Jim Hansen, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So, DR, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.